This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Are you afraid of the dark? You're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Welcome to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9. Right, that was Nancy Sinatra, of course, with Bang Bang from Kill Bill. Kill Bill 1 or 2? I haven't quite worked out which one it is.
Now, why would we have a song from Kill Bill? That's the first question.
Mm-hmm. It's our Tarantino attempt to tackle the Tarantino. It's not going to be easy, but look, we're going to give it our best shot this evening here on Sci-Fi and Scream. Hopefully we'll cover as many of the films that he has made and endured through the past three decades now. And so we'll be looking at the new one, Django Unchained. And we have in the studio to help us this evening, we have Tara. Tara Judah, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be here.
I hope we can do it tonight.
I think it's going to be an interesting show.
It will be. It could be a bit random at times. That's all right. And we've got Dr. Emma Beddoes back again.
Hello, hello. Well.
Right. And Mitch, of course.
I am here. Woo.
You are here.
Woo, woo, woo.
All right. So, yeah, I think Kill Bill was probably one of my favourites. But I think we need to possibly talk about the beginning of Tarantino's career. I don't know how everyone's feeling about that. The early days?
Yeah, do we want to start with Reservoir Dogs or do we want to go back kind of prior to that?
No. I mean, we could look at it a little bit. True Romance, of course, that I believe was something that he wrote initially.
Absolutely.
With Roger Avery.
Yeah, written by Tarantino, and I think that really kind of gave him a sort of leap to start off with. His writing is very intrinsic to his movies. He writes and directs all of his films, so they're not just directed by Tarantino films. They're films made by Quentin Tarantino, and he started out with Reservoir Dogs. I think he's been very strict from the very beginning as branding his films as a Quentin Tarantino film. He has his own production company, A Band Apart, so he's been very determined, I think, from the get-go to set himself up as an auteur and somebody with something to say. And certainly it's all about speech, because there's a lot in the dialogue of these films. Starting with Reservoir Dogs and all the way through to Django Unchained, his dialogue is very snappy. It's something that creates the character, the way that they speak. Language is also really important in his films, which we see to a greater extent probably when we get to Inglourious Basterds, the role that language plays. But certainly words are very important to him, and I think it's important to note that he started off as a writer, and that's really his kind of starting point.
Yeah. So pretty much from, well, I would say he's probably a VHS auteur from a video shop nerd. I believe he dropped out of school age 15 or 16, so the story he peddles or has fabricated maybe in some ways.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's actually almost like he's created a myth around himself where he worked in a video store, which is a story we all know. He watched pretty much everything during that time. And yes, it's true. I mean, I worked in a video store for a few years. You do get to watch a lot of films, so it is good for that kind of catching up. But I think he spent that time really observing rather than just watching. So paying attention not to genres, generic tropes, to the kinds of dialogue and the kinds of characters that those films were building, particularly things like the Western, the Kung Fu films. Oh, yeah. Those are the things that you get referenced a lot in his films. It's more of that kind of late night cool cult chic films rather than, you don't so much get a throwback to Hollywood classics or, you know, any of the sort of traditional arty ways of filmmaking, although I think aesthetically he does weave a lot of that into his style, but it's definitely more those B-movies, the grindhouse flicks, you know, that you see the references to in his work. And it's an interesting question, because then what you get from that is people saying, you know, what exactly is it that Tarantino's doing? Is he just paying homage to these films? Is he referencing them just for the kind of nerdiness of it so that people can watch and play along which things they get, what references they know? Is it for self-reflection? reflexivity? Is he a postmodernist filmmaker? And then there's been a lot of trying to save him from postmodernism by saying that he's pastiching.
I think it's more the pastiche. I think we were talking about it off air. Dr. Beddoes was talking about it too. It's almost like he accidentally has become this voice for a postmodern agenda, if you will. That's just my opinion. But
yeah, I think pastiche is a really useful term for discussing Quentin Tarantino's work, because it does more than just homage. It has a return to its historical context. It sort of pays homage to those things, but it also pays attention to what it is that it's presenting. It has a distance from it, and it works within quite often some of those aesthetics of the context that it's using. So with Grindhouse, for example, it uses Grindhouse aesthetics. It uses the kind of grainy look of film to situate that work back in the time that it's also set. So it's kind of marrying those two things in terms of content and also aesthetics to make sure that there's some kind of harmony between the two. And I think also there is a kind of desire to save it from a postmodern rambling, where it's not just things that are fragmented or fractured, that there is some kind of interconnectedness between what he's doing and what it's originally connected to.
Yeah, this is the big thing with him. I feel that, like I said, it's almost like he's an accidental tourist in a way in a cinema culture, not just American cinema culture. I mean, like you were saying, his influence on from the kung fu culture of films, you know, is it Lady Scorpion? I can't quite remember the name of one of his films. And the Jack Hill films, of course, too. They're pretty notorious. We're talking B grade. There's not a great amount of high sort of art in these movies, but...
No, but... And
they're more amusement, but you know what? I actually have to confess I really enjoy them.
I do too. I've always enjoyed Tarantino, and I think actually he's a director that, whilst he gets a lot of acclaim, he also gets a lot of flack. There was particularly, I think, around about the time of Death Proof and leading up to Inglourious Basterds, a lot of anti-Tarantino feeling out there, particularly amongst critics. I think that one of the things that people keep questioning is, you know, how long are we going to be in love with Tarantino for, and has he lost it? Because he kind of peaked with Pulp Fiction, and most people would kind of note that as the really big film that still has an incredible following. And then moving on to Kill Bill 1 and 2, there was still a lot of love for him. But after that, it started to dissipate a little bit. And I think that Death Proof really divided people. Potentially, it could be because it was a work that he did in conjunction with Robert Rodriguez to do with Planet Terror, and releasing that as Grindhouse made it not just a Tarantino film. It made it a product of, you know, a collaborative work, in a sense.
Collaborative work, which I don't know if Rodriguez is, this may be a terrible thing to say, but if he's actually almost kind of fits with Tarantino, but not really. In a way, it kind of brought it down to a very, I felt, quite a commercial level. Whereas I think with Tarantino, what I've always liked is that it is a bit offbeat at times. I personally, my favourite would have to be Jackie Brown. You know, it's one that often gets forgotten, possibly.
I think a lot of true and Tarantino devotees would say Jackie Brown's the best. I've heard that. I've had that a few times. It's not to say that it isn't the best, but no, just that it is a remarkable film, and it's an incredibly well-written film. It's also really a love letter to Pam Grier, which, you know, let's be honest, if you've got any kind of history of enjoying those films that she was in.
Foxy Brown,
absolutely. Then, you know, you're going to be somewhat entranced by Tarantino's affection for her. And I think that there's probably more affection in that film than there are in some of his later works.
Oh, definitely. Look, we'll be talking more about this and Tarantino on Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Do you know what a bounty hunter is?
You kill people and they give you a reward.
Badder they are, bigger the reward.
I'm looking for the Brittle brothers.
However, I don't know what they look like, but you do.
They called my wife.
They sold him.
But I don't know who to.
Calvin Candy.
That's the repelling gentleman who owns her.
Broomhilda is my property, and I can choose to do with my property whatever I so desire.
Help me find the Brittle brothers, and I'll take you to rescue your wife.
My name is Dr. King Schultz. This is my valet, Django.
Something up with these two. Them old boys done rode a lot of miles, went to a lot of trouble just to get that gal.
They playing your ass for a fool.
I spent my whole life surrounded by black faces. I only had one question.
Why don't they just rise up and kill the whites?
In my world, you gotta get dirty. So that's what I'm doing. I'm getting dirty.
What's your name?
Django. D-J-A-N-G-O. The D is silent. Django!
adult supervision is required.
Indeed, tonight adult supervision may be required. We are tackling the Tarantino, the man who maybe not quite postmodern enough for some of us, or is he kitsch or pastiche? We are looking into that tonight. That was the trailer from Django Unchained, and this is Sci-Fi and Scream with Sonia,
Mitch,
Dr. Emma,
and guest Tara.
And special guest Tara. Of course, Tara from Triple R's. Oh, what's the name of that podcast again? You know the one.
Oh, yeah. I think it's something about Plato's cave.
That's it. The shadows on the wall or on the cave. Now, diving into some shadows to do with Tarantino, this indeed would probably be his most shadiest, maybe. Django Unchained, of course, isn't out in Australia till the 24th, but it has been on screens in the US. It's a 2012 American epic western, written and directed by the man himself, Tarantino. It stars Jamie Foxx, the wonderful Christoph Waltz, who at present has been nominated, I think, for an Oscar, but has already cleaned up with the Golden Globe Best Supporting Actor. And, of course, it's got Leonardo DiCaprio as a quite menacing, nasty number.
Way.
Yes, way. Yes, he's good way. At doing that. The beautiful Kerry Washington. And, of course, Samuel L. Jackson appears again in another Tarantino film. It was released last year, like I said, in the US, but it's coming soon here, and we were very fortunate to see it. All right, so it is being called the slave epic movie of Tarantino's, and we're going to discuss what we think about that. Tara.
Where to begin with this one? This is a really fascinating film, almost endlessly fascinating. I think that overall it's quite a good film, although there are a lot of problems along the way. And I think that Tarantino is becoming more complicated. This is not a straightforward film in terms of its politics, even its racial politics. I think its treatment of race is both good and quite alarming at times. It's a very arresting film. The violence is different in this film, and I think that's probably something that we should talk a little bit about, is the depiction of violence in this film and how that compares to Tarantino's treatment of violence up until this point, because I do think there are times where it feels very different to what we've seen from him before, although it has some of the same stylistic elements. It's also a curious film that is constantly interested in its own modes of storytelling. It sets up the characters in a really interesting way. It aligns the audience really with the white character, mainly with Christoph Waltz. He's the person that we're kind of given as a guide. He's guiding Django, and he's really guiding the audience
too. And
he's
playing a German, so he's playing, I guess, for an American audience. Maybe they get off a little bit here scot-free, because he is a German. He's from the outside external environment. He's not a white American as such. He's a white European.
Absolutely.
Who is portrayed as someone, without spoiling it too much, is portrayed as a person who's a bounty hunter, who basically says he collects bodies for money, basically. People who are wanted on the wanted list, you know, dead or alive. It's got that Western element, which is kind of cute and a little bit cheesy, of course. But he's a person who is, he's filtering what we're seeing.
He's
guiding us through the story about a man who is, he frees the slave, Django. Just ruining that for you, in case you don't know about this film. He's freeing the slave Django and takes him under his wing as his accomplice, I guess, to do his bounty hunting work as he goes through winter. And he promises him, doesn't he, that when the snow melts, he will help him rescue his wife, because Django has been separated from his wife. For people who don't know, I think it was up till the Emancipation Era, if you were a black African slave in America, you could not actually be married to another black African slave. It was basically illegal to do that.
Along with a lot of other civic rights.
That, a lot of other massive
human
amount.
Rights.
Exactly.
And this is set 2 years before the Civil War
breaks out.
So, and you get that from the very beginning. So you're given the context. And, you're given the guide of Christoph Waltz's character as someone who, absolutely, you're right, isn't aligned with the North or the South. And so politically he's kind of giving himself a little bit of a leeway to have some distance from this film. And that character certainly probably reflects what a majority of the audience would think. You know, he even says things like, I don't condone slavery. I need to use you, Django, in a certain way to get what we both want as a, desired result. Says he feels somewhat uncomfortable about that, but does it anyway. He's kind of the moral compass in the film. And whatever Christoph Waltz's character does, King Schultz, his name is, we're aligned with him and kind of go along with that. And it's interesting because I think, too, that that means that our gaze is aligned with his quite often. And where he feels uncomfortable, the things that he watches that he feels uncomfortable with is the cue for the audience to feel
uncomfortable. Well, we get a lot of those wonderful B-grade zoom-in shots, don't we, of people's faces, and a lot of close-cropped shots, too, head-shoulder shots of the Dr. Schultz, who's, you know, our person that's taking it, the narrator in a way, quiet narrator.
What do you guys give it out of the stars, the star rating? What's on your star?
Oh, look, it's really hard. I'm sort of wondering, Dr. Emma, what do you think?
What do I think about stars or about the movie in
about
general?
About the movie, what would you give it?
Well,
it's a tough one.
I hadn't actually thought about what I would give it out of five, because I think, as we've all pointed out, it's just, it's so complex. There's so much to talk about. I don't think I've even been able to digest it well enough to be able to give it a rating. I mean, for me, Tara, you mentioned the violence in the movie, which is quite different to what we've come to expect from Tarantino. And I agree with you. And I think for me, I felt like there was kind of an uneasy tension between a really sort of brutal, honest, historically rooted form of violence and a really stylistic form of violence. I felt like we were shown both of those. And for me, there was a little bit of an uneasy tension between them. In one scene, you know, you'd find yourself feeling actually very uncomfortable, very confronted. And in another, you then see red jelly flying through the air.
It was like,
absolutely. And that was that
comical in that respect.
Yeah,
the violence isn't comical, but the way we see the special effects, it felt kind of,
but
like
some of it is and some comic of it isn't. And there was this
that's a very fascinating different stylistic technique that he uses in this film, and I think that it's an important distinction, because particularly when you do have that almost completely over the top, you know, excessive blood and defying of gravitational laws killings, those sequences, I think, are the ones that remind you that this isn't history as is. This is a mythical tale. This is an invention for storytelling purposes, and that's what those scenes represent. The other violence, and I know exactly what you're talking about, Emma, are those moments where it's usually violence against the slave laborers, and it's extremely horrific, and the gaze is held, and it makes the viewer feel really uncomfortable, because you feel implicit in what's happening to those people at those times just by watching it. And I think that the reason that that violence is more realistic, shall we say, or more naturalistic, is because it's heinous and it actually occurred. You know, there is some respect from Tarantino. I think those are the moments that he's actually paying some respect to what happened in America, and not just providing entertainment for the audience and saying, look, you can enjoy this film, but this is also a really serious, you know,
it's a serious
historical topic,
course,
yeah, that you need to have some respect for.
Yep.
See, for me, I actually found that quite uneasy, even though he may have been doing that as a point of paying respect to what actually happened. I felt that presenting that in that manner within this kind of, you know, spaghetti Western genre film felt, it felt like it wasn't, for something that hasn't really been dealt with very well in American cinema, it felt like it was not really helping in dealing with that properly. That was just my feeling.
That's a really good point, actually. I think that there isn't a lot of cinematic works that deal particularly well with this event in history. Let's be honest, a lot of the grand sweeping epics that have been made about this era are pretty dicey in terms of their politics, if I'm thinking specifically of Gone with the Wind. But
I don't want to go there, but
this is Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Hey, this is Fran Kranz, Joss Whedon's Basil, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on 94.9.
This is Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9, and we are talking to Django.
Jungle. I don't know why I've put that silly accent on.
Jenga.
It doesn't sound at all American. This is Sci-Fi and Scream, yes, on Joy Django.
And we are playing
FM.
Jenga.
We could be right now in studio.
You guys can imagine it.
Yeah. So we've got Dr. Emma and Tara in the studio with us as well. And we were getting, pretty excited about this latest film, the epic. It's not a spaghetti Western. It's, I guess, a slavery Western, you could say, in a way, about American culture. It's, of course, based in 1858. However, I think it's probably more relevant to the era we live in now. And maybe, just like everything else, he's like a litmus piece of paper, Tarantino. He seems to absorb things that are happening, I think, in the common culture at the moment, or current contemporary activities and so on. And also, we've talked about the violence. Is it immature? Is it comical? How serious it is with such a grave and very complex and serious topic, such as slavery in the American history.
Yes. The violence question. Well, Emma was just raising the point earlier about, you know, whether or not he has a responsibility, perhaps, to present this material in a different way.
Or whether he has a right.
Or, yeah, indeed, if he has the right to represent this material at all. And those are always extremely good questions with this sort of subject material. I think that what's interesting is that we've probably seen so many Holocaust films that we're quite used to a broad range of representations with them, but perhaps this is a very underrepresented topic on film.
I do tend to agree with that, and that was my thinking on Inglourious Basterds. I think that's why it felt okay for him to do that, because we've already had so many, like you said, representations of that specific, you know, time in history, that it felt the people were sort of happy to see a fictional retelling of that era. But with Django, we haven't really seen much, you know, really good, honest representation of
probably
of
not
what happened.
I would say probably not for at least a generation. I mean, the 1970s was a great watershed time. We had miniseries like one's called Holocaust, which had the wonderful Meryl Streep in it and James Woods. Now, that was a fictional family, the Weiss family, who were German Jews. Now, that had some horrific moments in it and was one of the highest rating Emmy Award winning TV series of its time. I think even bigger than The Walking Dead, if that's possible.
Get out.
Yeah, get out.
They didn't even use Impact for their font.
They didn't need to. Now, Roots was another one. Roots was a very important television miniseries based on Alex Haley's novel, Roots, The Saga of an American Family. Of course, Alex Haley's incredibly important in the civil rights movement, friend of Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, associate with people like that and Malcolm X and so on and so on from the 60s and 50s and 60s. Now, Roots was, it did show some graphic violent moments there, but I think there's been so little in the last 35 years that, is this why people are getting upset with Django? Because we haven't seen such a...
This is also curious because, I mean, this is a much earlier history, and yet in many ways it's probably one that particularly America, and perhaps to a large extent the rest of the Western world also, haven't really dealt with in any kind of efficient or satisfying way.
There's been no compensation for one thing.
Exactly. This is a history that is still being denied a voice. The Holocaust has been widely acknowledged. Indeed, it's a crime not to acknowledge it. So this is universally acknowledged. Everybody has agreed to acknowledge those crimes against humanity. There's something a bit more insidious, I think, going on with the civil rights movement and the way in which perhaps we haven't come to terms with it as a collective memory yet. Perhaps there hasn't been enough acknowledgement of these events. And so it's curious in the contemporary climate that Tarantino should really choose this as his moment in history to represent. We've also been seeing a spate of our recent history on screen. You know, we're still seeing the Iraq War an awful lot at the moment. We're seeing the troubles in Afghanistan being
depicted on screen. And one woman director doing both films.
One woman doing it.
Good on you, Catherine Bigelow. We love you.
And so, this is something very different and perhaps something that is a curious choice. And I think that it is going to cause a lot of controversy. In a sense, Tarantino likes to do that. He likes to stir up the pot and bring these things to the forefront. I'm not really sure what the answer to the question is. I don't think that it's easy. I think actually it's quite complicated. Yeah. I think on the one hand, there might be moments in this film where I do think he's being a bit disrespectful, and there are other moments in this film where I do think that he's telling
a
good story.
He's been spot on, I think. But there were moments where I felt a bit uncomfortable and Emma felt a bit uncomfortable, and we heard people chuckling and laughing. There were two very muscular, fit and athletic African-American men wrestling, which looks in front of a fireplace with, what's his name, Monsieur Candy, of course, played wonderfully and nastily by Leonardo DiCaprio, who's usually a Scorsese favourite, but...
Does he have a mustache?
Oh, he has a sort of a goatee, like, a southern goatee.
That might make a difference in the scenario.
But in any case, it's a really confronting scene. We've got a fireplace, so it looks like a comforting sort of environment. It's a boudoir, so, you know, there's that aspect of sexuality there. And, you know, we've got these high-rolling white men from the South. I believe it's Mississippi. Now, Mississippi was one of the worst cases of slavery and still has a very bad case of racism, of course. Mm. So we see these two men wrestling, and we realise that they're actually wrestling to the death. Spoiler: they are wrestling to the death. That was a really difficult scene to watch because they are killing each other, and it's the amusement of white people watching and making bets, and that was very disturbing. I heard people laughing in the cinema. I wasn't happy with that. I wasn't comfortable, even though Franco Nero was in there. I still had, you know, a bit of an issue with that.
That scene's a really good one to isolate and use as an example, because what is happening in that scene is twofold. This is a representation of the kinds of things that did happen. These things did occur. So in one sense, it's not presenting them as spectacle. It's presenting this as a heinous act that did occur during this time. That's one of the moments that actually has a little bit of historical accuracy. And the people, the white people on screen at that time, the way in which they're behaving is actually split. And I would say, look, it's really disappointing that anybody would laugh during a sequence like that. And I do know, appreciate that sometimes you go along to see a film with an audience who don't respond to things in the same way as you do.
Of course.
But I think that we should probably return to the King Schultz character, who is uncomfortable during that scene. And given that we've been given him as the setup at the beginning of the film as our moral compass, I feel as though we are supposed to align our view with his, and he is uncomfortable during that scene. He doesn't want to look. He's pretending to enjoy it and have revelry in it because it's presented to him as a spectacle, but he's not enjoying it. And in a sense, that's actually maybe a commentary on the on our position in the audience as being presented with this as a spectacle, but feeling really uncomfortable and not quite knowing where to gaze.
Good point. This is Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Hi, this is Bobcat Goldthwait, and here I am appearing. Well, I'm actually, you're listening to me here only on Sci-Fi and Scream, and that's on Joy 94.9.
This is Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9, and that was Jeepsters by T-Rex, and that's from the Death Proof movie.
Yeah, 2007, Death Proof, excellent. Well, we just had a message as well from Robert in Caulfield. He says, with Obama's inauguration today, for a second term, Tarantino has captured the, can I say German, Zeitgeist, and reignited this discussion on US history. Interesting point. Mm-hmm. What do people think about that?
What does Zeitgeist mean?
Well, I guess it's like the flavour, the...
It's like capturing the
times that we live in, apparently.
Yeah, yeah, the cultural climate of the time.
Okay.
The incubus.
That's a good summary.
We don't really have a German translated word for it because in English we use the word Zeitgeist. So it's one of those appropriated terms that we don't, there's no real English equivalent.
Exactly. It's a bit like Araha. There is no English version for Araha. All right.
Like demi-glaze.
Well, I think there is for demi-glaze.
No, because isn't demi-glaze a French word?
It's a half-glazed piece of fruit, isn't it?
Oh, you wouldn't say half-glazed. Who says half-glazed?
I had no idea. All right, what are we talking about? We're talking about Tarantino. We're tackling the Tarantino. We had some real efforts with a Django Unchained, but we didn't even score it because it's just a little bit too difficult, too fresh.
It's in a grey area.
The blood's too fresh.
It is. It's too fresh. That's what it is.
Sometimes it's not appropriate to give a rating. Is it okay to say that?
Yep. Go for it. Now, the music of Tarantino, I think maybe we could, perhaps if we've got time, to touch on that a little bit if people feel like that. Now, that was some track that we had from the 2007 film, Death Proof. Yep, that's right. And like anything that Tarantino does, what I find really fascinating is he's similar to Martin Scorsese because he's also an eclectic record collector, I guess. But Tarantino says that he finds sometimes even the stories or scenes he's going to do in a film through some of the tracks that he has at home. I mean, records obviously lying about. He must have millions.
He must indeed. His use of music really made popular that kind of kitsch appropriation or that use of music in film. Although he's credited as being kind of the first person to do it, but obviously he isn't. I mean, particularly if you've ever watched any Kenneth Anger films, Scorpio Rising is the film that really kind of started this as a kitsch movement and a camp movement. And Kenneth Anger's American underground filmmaker and he started off an American independent movement in a sense, or he was one of the key filmmakers who began that American independent filmmaking. And Tarantino's really the kind of mainstream crossover, I guess, from that underground movement. So it all comes from somewhere else. But certainly Tarantino's used it in a way that has really credited him with creating a kind of cinema of cool. He's sort of known as this generation's, you know, he's a very important filmmaker in terms of contemporary filmmaking, but also someone who speaks to a generation in terms of crossing over between geekdom, because he represents a real film geek. He represents somebody who comes from a geeky kind of, you know, that video store shut-in background that he paints as his own mythology makes him appeal to geeks and to film geeks, and that knowing references that he has in his film. But his films are also incredibly stylized and really cool. So even if you don't get the references, you can still get the aesthetic of the cool, and get the language of
often,
the cool.
It's often music that you might have overlooked, or you've heard in your childhood, your parents might have played, and you've gone, oh, that's really naff. Don't really get into that. And then he's like this amazing archaeologist. He's able to pull it out and put it with a scene, and it just works so beautifully. Probably one of the most well-known would be Stuck in the Middle with You by Steel Wheelers. Famous scene is Reservoir Dogs. I'm almost Australian. Reservoir, that's how you pronounce it.
Reservoir.
Okay. Reservoir Dogs. And that was his earliest or his first debut film, the scene with the razor and that song, I think pretty much probably put those guys back on the map for one thing, that band.
Absolutely. Also, it's classic filmmaking technique of taking two different things and appropriating them, that they're juxtaposed against one another, but using them together to kind of heighten the emotion in that scene. It's really goes back to kind of Soviet montage and, you know, early filmmaking practices. When you take an image and a different, well, in this case, a different type of sound, and one that you wouldn't necessarily expect to go with that.
Sometimes
that
they don't mix at all. I mean, what has got lime and the coconut got to do with anything about being hitmen and going on the rampage, or, you know, doing a heist that goes wrong, and if you know Reservoir Dogs, but also there's so many other songs as well that he's made those songs don't make sense.
Popular again, actually, too. That's the other thing is, you know, bringing a lot of those things into the mainstream and using them in this way, removing them from their original context, which, again, you know, we can argue for hours as to whether or not it's appropriate to always do that and whether or not this is a good thing or a bad thing, but it certainly has made a lot of that music popular again and has brought it to the forefront.
Okay, I'm going to ask the big question now. I'm going to go round the table, round the panel, and everyone's going to pick their favourite Tarantino song or piece of music. Why? And you've only got, like, 30 seconds. Sorry about that.
Piece of music? I thought you were going to say movie. Hello, yeah.
Sorry. From whichever movie it is.
I choose Nancy Sinatra, Bang Bang, Kill Bill.
Okay, huzzah. Why?
Because it's on the list in front of me.
No, come on. It's cool. It's got Uma Thurman in a yellow outfit. I mean, hello, looking like a blonde Bruce Lee.
Actually, to be honest, I actually have never seen Kill Bill.
All right, moving on.
But I really liked that song when it got re-released and remade.
I didn't know it
became popular because of Kill Bill, but it did. Mm. And so that was an eye-opener for me, and I was like, oh, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
And so that's a song that I really like. Huzzah.
Good one. Dr. Beddoes.
I'm going to go with Baby It's You by Smith from Death Proof. Death Proof's my favourite Tarantino movie. And also it's partly because I love the scene in which we see Baby It's You, because that movie is sort of a pastiche or homage, whatever we want to decide on, whether it's postmodern or not, of a particular era, you know, of movies, but I like how it's sort of a contemporary twist. So we've got this very like 70s gritty aesthetic, but she's sitting there listening to it on an iPod in her car. And I really liked that that blending of those, you know, two different kind of, you know, the contemporary and the old, I guess. And I liked that. And the song's just beautiful. I love the song.
It's a beautiful song.
Yeah.
Tara?
Along with my inability to give a star rating, I'm unable to pick a favourite song. It seems too difficult in too short a period of time. You sprung this on me and I'm not prepared. But I do just want to say that, yeah, that's fantastic. Also to bring up Death Proof, because we've barely spoken about that film. And it is a really important film because it's, you know, an incredibly feminist film for Tarantino.
It has Zoe Bell, you know, knocking it out. And she was in Django. Django last night.
Django. The D is silent.
I'm going to go for, and this is one that I had almost forgotten about, but I found was just iconic for him, for his films. Let's Stay Together by the Reverend Al Green. Who can forget that in Pulp Fiction 1994? I mean, all you see is the back of that wonderful actor's head, and he's doing that monologue. And to Vincent, I believe it's Vincent. Is it Marcellus? Marcellus, the character's doing that monologue.
Yeah.
And the song is in the background, and it's just this beautiful soul song. You have no idea what's the relationship between what he's saying and the song. No relationship at all, but just a great song.
Mm. It is a fantastic song.
And can I just say, while we're on music, before we move on from music, really quickly, I just wanted to say, I think also the use of music in his movies creates a worldly experience. So you're not just experiencing this is a movie. You actually, the soundtracks give you such, like, it's like the aura of the film and the world that it's set in. You actually have a feel for the characters and their stories when you listen to it. It sort of becomes, it adds texture to the world. It gives it more. And I think that's a really important thing for how audiences engage with his films and the way they consume it.
It's like walking to your very favourite cafe, and you know that the pizza's a good deal, you know that other things there and refreshments are a good sign too, and you're meeting friends.
Yeah.
Who ordered the pizza?
Hopefully.
This is Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Burgers, the cornerstone of any nutritious breakfast.
What kind of hamburgers?
Cheeseburgers.
No. Where'd you get them? McDonald's, Wendy's, Jack in the Box, where?
Big Kahuna Burger.
Big Kahuna Burger? That's that Hawaiian burger joint. You mind if I try one of yours?
Mm-hmm. This is a tasty burger. Me, I can't usually get them because my girlfriend's a vegetarian, which pretty much makes me a vegetarian, but I do love the taste of a good burger. You know what they call a quarter pounder with cheese in France? Royale with cheese. You know why they call it that?
Because of the metric system?
Check out the big brain on bread. That's right. The metric system.
This is Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9. That is a good burger. It's all to do with the metric system. Thank you so much to Samuel L. Jackson, an awesome icon of a man, a brilliant actor, who I don't think Tarantino knows what he's got, because he's got one of the best actors in his repertoire group there.
Who ordered the pizza?
Yeah, I'm getting hungry right now. So it's been a great show. There's so much to say about Tarantino. I think we started tackling them by the ankles, but there's still a lot more to do. So I want to say thank you very much to Tara, Judah, coming into the studio this evening.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always so much fun and not enough time to talk about these things.
I think we need to do a podcast, a special podcast, and to Dr. Emma Beddoes as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Mitch.
And thanks, Sonia.
I'll come again next week.
And we also have next week, it's Alien Abductions. We're talking a little bit about that.
Yeah,
it's going to be really,
it's going to be very probing, I feel.
Probing. Very personal, very close.
That's next week on the show on Sci-Fi and Scream. Yep.
Thank you so much. And also, I have to say my favourite, I thought Dawn of the Dead. No,
Dust Till Dawn.
Dust Till Dawn with Tarantino, but it might not be.
We'll be doing Romero next week, maybe, for you, Mitch. Then we can do all Romero, the Dawns, all the Deads,
Desperado,
all the time.
Desperado, Dawn of the Dead.
That's Rodriguez.
That's Rodriguez. Leave him out of
this. Leave him alone.
This is Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
She was a vampire who could never see the light of day.
He was a zombie shuffling his way through the afterlife.
Love would bring them together.
But human flesh would tear them apart.
They were doomed to be on Sci-Fi and Scream.
Tuesday nights from 10 on Joy 94.9.
Joy.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.